Canada, tariffs, and nuclear. As the United States continues to wage a self-generated trade war with our soon-to-be former allies up north, Canada is poised to make an irreversible nuclear mistake that will put it at the mercy of the good intentions of the U.S., which, let's face it, right now are in short supply and may evaporate completely in the future. The province of Ontario has been in the process of purchasing and building 4 U.S. nuclear reactors that require fuel that is manufactured solely in the United States. The faulty thinking behind this step should be, but isn't yet, self-evident to Ontario Premier Doug Ford, who is in charge and is charging ahead with these nukes. As the elbows-out self-protective actions of Canada run the gamut from fighter jets to bourbon, it takes a genuine expert, a physicist, mathematician, and veteran nuclear consultant to get to the heart of the vulnerability that thus far the country seems to be ignoring. And when he tells us,
"We're trying to cancel the order for foreign jets from the United States, and yet we're on the hook for buying foreign reactors from the United States that would require fueling from the United States at all. How to put yourself at the mercy of your economic enemy, put them in charge of supplying the fuel that you need to run your electricity system. It doesn't seem like a very smart move."
Well, when Dr. Gordon Edwards, president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, lays out the problem of importing U.S. nuclear reactors to Canada in the middle of a trade war, in addition to the elimination of multiple safety systems in these nukes to make them, quote-unquote, smaller, and no one in the Canadian government seems to have noticed or figured this out yet, you get that sinking feeling as you watch a totally avoidable expansion of that awful, dangerous, deadly seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who would like to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevy. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a knockout interview with Dr. Gordon Edwards, president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. We focus on the 4 U.S. nuclear reactors Ontario is in the process of importing, why they threaten to provide an irreversible vulnerability to Canada's sovereignty, and the guarantee that eventually the country could be forced into becoming the 51st state of the United States by nuclear blackmail. This is one of the best and most powerful interviews I've ever conducted for the show, and I urge you to not only listen to it, but share it widely. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, the ICAN update, a monthly report from the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, with Lucero Oyarzun standing in for Alistair Burnett, and more honest nuclear information than we are bound to get in any made-up justification for those tariffs. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, April 1st, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., last Friday, March 28th, marked the 46th anniversary of the Three Mile Island power plant's meltdown on March 28, 1979. That was Unit 2, and now advocates for the continued closure of Unit 1 gathered at Pennsylvania's state capitol to assert that the proposed reopening of that part of the nuclear complex would represent a renewed threat to public health. Gene Stilp, A former congressional candidate and Pennsylvania activist who led the protest said, "The safest way to mitigate any radiation hazard is to eliminate the source. In the present case, that means no restart of TMI Unit 1 is the safest course for you, your family, and your friends." The reactor was closed for economic reasons in 2019 by its owner, Constellation Energy, formerly Entergy, but is now proposed to resume generating in 2028 to supply electricity exclusively to technology giant Microsoft to run some of its data centers. To be continued. In Minnesota, the Monticello nuclear plant shut down last Wednesday after a control valve issue. Owner-operator Xcel Energy is working to power down the nuclear facility to make repairs after a new leak of radioactive water was reported this week. 2 years ago, Xcel Energy revealed a leak of approximately 400,000 gallons of water containing radioactive tritium. The leak occurred in November 2022, but the public was not informed until March 2023. And a second leak was reported at the end of March 2023. The facility is scheduled to continue operating through 2040. In Iran, an advisor to Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has warned Iran will, quote, have no choice but to seek nuclear weapons if attacked. Rising tensions between Iran and the U.S. have reignited concerns over military conflict. Since taking office, Trump has reinstated his maximum pressure campaign, and while Tehran has denied seeking nuclear weapons, recent warnings signal a growing risk of escalation. Iran's former parliamentary speaker, Ali Larijani, said, "We are not moving towards nuclear weapons, but if you do something wrong in the Iranian nuclear issue, you will force Iran to move towards that because it has to defend itself." Now here's the ICAN update. Direct from the headquarters of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons in Geneva, Switzerland, with Lucero Oyarzun standing in for Alistair Burnett.
This is Lucero Oyarzun from Geneva with the March 2025 roundup of news from the campaign. To kick us off with some good news, we have seen several cities across Italy, Belgium, and Greece call on their governments to join the UN treaty banning nuclear weapons under the ICAN Cities Appeal in the past 2 weeks. We always welcome these updates and the pressure they imply on national governments. It's also an encouraging sign that our campaigners have no plan of slowing down after the whirlwind of activity that was the 3MSP in New York. At its final tally, the third meeting of states parties to the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons had 89 state participants, 1,000 representatives from 163 civil society organizations, including many affected community voices, and 9 international organizations. We also saw over 70 events take place in the UN and across the city during Nuclear Ban Week. All of this resulted not just in a rallying moment for the campaign, but also a powerful political declaration rejecting nuclear weapons and challenging nuclear deterrence. And that rejection of nuclear weapons suddenly seems more urgent than ever. From early March, leaders from umbrella states, particularly in Europe, have been giving some incredibly worrying signals, openly encouraging nuclear proliferation under the guise of a conversation about a European deterrent. Here with me to discuss more about this is Florian Ebelenkamp, ICAN's advocacy officer. Florian, can you tell us a bit more about what we are seeing from these European leaders and why it's so worrying?
What we've seen is a proposal by French President Macron on Europeanizing the French nuclear arsenal. This comes at a moment of great political difficulty for him, where he has lost control over the French parliament and his political options are really, really slim. So he needs some sort of glorifying moment for himself that would unite the country around him. And at the same time, we see a panic reaction by many other European leaders, an unclear positioning of the new US administration, of Trump's team, towards NATO. And so that has led some of the European heads of governments or head of state engage in this debate more than they had previously. So we've seen, for example, the future German Chancellor Friedrich Merz engage on this. We've seen voices from Scandinavian countries thinking this is a good idea. We've seen the Prime Minister and the President of Poland saying that they would need nuclear weapons as well. So it seems like this is spiraling out of control more than before, but yet it hasn't led to any concrete policy change. That's also important to remember. This is incredibly worrying, and I think we can answer this from two sides. One is that nuclear weapons do not provide security. It's a distraction at best and a danger, more realistically, to Europe, because European nuclear weapons are meant to be used in Europe. And at the same time, there's a massive cost attached if such projects would go ahead. For example, of course, the financial cost, billions would be spent on this. That could be spent on so many better causes. And also there's a cost in terms of undermining international law. The NPT, of course, is what all these European governments have fought to do to protect over the last years, and have actually accused ICAN and the TPNW movement to undermine. And now we see the very same governments undermining this treaty by openly talking about nuclear proliferation. So that's bad.
Yeah, that's terrible. The good news is that we've already heard very clear pushback to this, perhaps not as much as we would like, but we heard the first pushback already during the 3MSP. And in the weeks since, a lot of voices are getting louder in the opinion sections around Europe. So what has been said and why is this so important?
Yes, it's true. And it's in a way, it's very encouraging to see how many people are out there in our campaign and elsewhere who now wake up and put their voices out there arguing against nuclear proliferation. We've seen articles that ICAN published, but also that some of our partner organizations in France, in Germany, in Norway, in Scotland, in some other countries have been doing. And I know there's more coming, so we'll share those. I think it's very essential that we contribute to this debate by removing this abstract layer that this conversation still has in the political realm, that we don't just talk about, you know, extended deterrence or forward proliferation or friendly proliferation in terms that no one can really grasp, but actually talk about what this would mean. And it means nuclear arms race in Europe. It would mean Europe being the target of these weapons. It would mean, of course, insane humanitarian catastrophe in Europe. And there's really little defense value or military value of these weapons. So that's kind of some of the arguments we're making. And hopefully this can be a moment where we can show the strength of our campaign and push back to at least, you know, if not achieve disarmament, at least avoid further proliferation of nuclear weapons.
Thank you. And you've hit on the final question I wanted to ask, which is, in short, what happens now? What is the one thing that campaigners or people around the world who are worried about these developments can do?
We've seen, for example, on our website, there's a big interest in just facts around nuclear weapons. Who has those weapons? How big are they? How many are there? So first, I would encourage everyone to keep their websites updated, you know, put out the information. People are in need of facts. And then publish articles, make your opinions heard, contact your local newspapers, no matter how small these are. Every contribution to this public debate matters. Also, contact your representatives. These are the people that will ultimately decide on your country going nuclear or not, or your country leaving an international treaty or not. So they need to hear from you that you are worried about this. They need to hear that there's, you know, that there's an opinion, and a very, very based opinion in the public about this and against nuclear weapons, and make it as hard for them as possible to give in to this nuclear nonsense.
That was Florian Edlenkamp, ICAN's advocacy officer, talking from Geneva with us about the European proliferation conversation. And this is Lucero Yersun, ending the March news roundup for Nuclear Hot Seat.
Now here's this week's featured interview. Dr. Gordon Edwards is a mathematician, physicist, nuclear consultant, and president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. He is one of our most cogent thinkers on nuclear issues, and he regularly puts together the pieces to give us a clear picture of exactly what is going on, why we should be alarmed, and what we can do about it. Here, in light of Trump's tariff tantrum and threats to annex Canada as our 51st state, Dr. Edwards spells out the problems of Ontario's planned importation of 4 U.S.-made nuclear reactors, along with the safety issues created in these units by elimination of multiple safety systems in order to be able to label them small. I can honestly call this one of the most important interviews I've conducted in almost 14 years of producing Nuclear Hot Seat every week. I spoke with Dr. Edwards on Tuesday, April 1st, 2025, and I swear this is not an April Fool's joke. This is for real. So fasten your seatbelts. Dr. Gordon Edwards, thanks so much for joining us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
My pleasure, Libby.
Let's start with where things are right now. What is the current, or at least the most recent, energy scenario in Canada as regards nukes? How many do you have? How much energy are they creating? And what happens to the energy?
Well, Up until the present, Canada has had only Canadian-designed nuclear reactors using natural uranium, which we produce ourselves. And so we have a completely closed system. We are totally self-sufficient in our own nuclear industry. We do export, 85% of our uranium is exported overseas to other reactors, and that requires enrichment services, which are now hard to come by right now because of the Russia-Ukrainian war. You know that a lot of the enrichment, enriched uranium, even from the United States, was being purchased from Russia as a result of the closure of the traditional enrichment plants in the United States. And so now that there's an embargo against buying things from Russia, that makes it difficult to actually secure these contracts. Now, Canada has not ordered a new nuclear reactor since 1978, a nuclear power reactor. Except for one, and that is the BWRX-300. This is a GE Hitachi boiling water reactor, which would require enriched fuel, and which is an American design, and which would be purchased from the United States and also fueled with uranium bought from the United States, enriched uranium, since we do not have any enrichment capabilities in Canada. So for the first time, we would have a nuclear reactor that is coming from another country and whose fuel supply is purchased from another country as well. That other country happens to be Trump's United States of America, and Trump seems to have declared a more or less economic war against Canada. He seems to be indicating that he would like to put Canada into dire consequences economically so as to be able to acquire Canada as the 51st state. This is a very hostile takeover, if you want to put it that way, scenario, very similar to his announced plans for getting Greenland one way or the other. It sounds very ominous and it sounds very threatening. And Canadians have not responded well to this nasty turn, as you might say. So the result is that we're really have a strong sensation here in Canada that we have to become more independent of the United States. Stop buying U.S. products. There's a strong buy Canadian right across from coast to coast to coast in Canada, because we have three oceans, the Arctic Ocean as well. There is this strong feeling that we should buy Canadian, that we should avoid buying from the United States, because the United States right now is not a reliable supplier. And to put our electricity system at the mercy of Trump's goodwill seems foolish, because Trump is looking for any way that he can put pressure on Canada to make it more amenable to the idea of being actually taken over by the United States and be made into the 51st state. So where we're at right now is that we have a new order since 2021 for American reactors that would be so-called small modular reactors, but they're really not small. They're 21 stories high. That doesn't sound like a small reactor to me. And these are totally American design, and they would be totally using American fuel, American supplied fuel. So we now have a prime minister, a new prime minister just within the last little while, Mark Carney, who used to be in charge of the Bank of England and the Bank of Canada. And now he's prime minister of Canada. He has already said that they are reconsidering the purchase of American fighter jets. $87 billion worth of American jets, 16 of which have already been partially paid for by Canada. But now we're considering the possibility of buying the rest of that order of jets from Sweden rather than from the United States. We also have several provinces which have taken American alcoholic beverages off their shelves. And this has already hurt the bourbon industry in the United States. It turns out that Ontario was one of the biggest purchasers of American bourbon, and taking it off the shelves is no favor to the Americans. But then again, we're not getting favors back from our side either. So we really have friendly feelings towards the American people. We've been partners for such a long time. We've been friends for a long time. We've had the longest undefended border in the world. And it's a shame to see that all sort of going down the drain right now. So the question is, why should we be buying American reactors?
So the question is, with Canada in the process of withdrawing from various economic commitments that have been made or believed to have been made with the United States, why are they now trying to buy U.S. nuclear reactors that require U.S. fuel when you're in a closed system that doesn't require any contact with the United States in order to perpetuate your nuclear industry?
Well, that's absolutely correct. And it is a puzzlement because it seems that under the current circumstances, it would be the smartest thing to do would be to stop the contract to purchase four BWRX 300 reactors. These are the boiling water reactor version 10. The X stands for 10. So BWR is boiling water reactor X, 10.
And are these the same as the small modular nuclear reactors that are under discussion?
Well, they call them small modular reactors, but in fact, they're 21 stories high, 11 stories above ground, and 12 stories below ground. So it's rather hard to see why they would be called small. And modular, they're not really modular either. Certainly the first ones are not going to be modular because they're going to be the first of a kind. The only way that you can really get the modular idea going is to have orders for hundreds or thousands of these reactors, and then you can start mass producing the components. That was the idea, that you could mass produce these components and make it quicker and easier to assemble. But you're not going to build a mass production plant when you only have one order or three orders or four orders. So the use of the phrase small modular reactor is a misnomer in itself. The real problem is that Ontario has already committed to building four of these BWRX 300 reactors from the GE Hitachi Corporation, which is based in Wilmington, North Carolina. And a lot of people are thinking that we should just cancel that order and start from scratch and reconsider the whole idea. But our government has been fooled, like many governments have been around the world, into thinking that nuclear is going to be a valuable aid in fighting climate change. And therefore, because fighting climate change is regarded as urgent by our government, they don't want to delay the building of these reactors. However, nuclear power is very slow to build, no matter where you order it from. These have already been ordered since 2021. And in fact, the license that was issued for preparing the site for these reactors was issued way back in 2011, believe it or not. So the result is that we're talking about one of the slowest energy sources to deploy and also one of the most expensive energy sources that are available. According to Lazard, the Wall Street firm that advises investors on energy matters, they say that the highest estimated cost of wind with storage and solar energy with storage, the highest cost of those is far less than the lowest cost of nuclear. And so the question is, how do you make nuclear affordable? How do you make it deployable in time to actually make a difference in climate change? And how do you make it pay back its cost? Because again, these prices tend to escalate and soar out of control. They double or triple very often before the project is completed. We've seen this already. In the United States, there was a project of small modular reactors called NuScale, and the price just about doubled. And all the investors backed out, and that project is now dead. It's joined onto the scrap heap. So we have a complicated situation here where we're trying to cancel the order for foreign jets from the United States, and yet we're on the hook for buying foreign reactors from the United States that would require fueling from the United States at all. How to put yourself at the mercy of your economic enemy, put them in charge of supplying the fuel that you need to run your electricity system? It doesn't seem like a very smart move. So how this is going to shake out, we don't know, but that's one of the concerns that's going on. Now, in order to try and make these reactors, the SMRX reactor, more affordable, because it's very expensive, in order to make it more affordable, what they've done is they've taken a previously designed reactor called the Economic Simplified Boiling Water Reactor that was actually licensed in the United States back in 2011. And it turned out that it was very expensive and it was never built. It was actually modeled after the Fukushima reactors that melted down in that very same year, 2011. So the three reactors that melted down at Fukushima were in fact boiling water reactors built by GE Hitachi. And the Economic Simplified Boiling Water Reactor was a simplification of that, but it was never built. And now they have an even further simplified version, which is the BWRX-10. They've made it 90% smaller, partly by eliminating many safety systems. So in order to reduce the cost and make it smaller, they've cut out a whole bunch of safety systems that were previously regarded as essential. Some of these safety systems are, for example, the emergency core cooling system. The emergency core cooling system is designed to provide emergency cooling when the ordinary cooling is lost, so as to prevent a meltdown. That's exactly to prevent a meltdown. That's gone. They have, in the pressure vessel, they have what are called overpressure relief valves to prevent the vessel from bursting. If it bursts, of course, then it's impossible to cool the fuel and you can't avoid a meltdown. So they've eliminated the overpressure relief valves. And they also had a thing called the core catcher, which is if there was a core meltdown, they have a device at the bottom that will catch the core as it melts and prevent it from melting through at the bottom. They've eliminated that. So they've eliminated a whole bunch of safety systems as a way of saving money. And they're instead depending upon one single system, which is called the isolation condenser system. Now, basically, I'll tell you what that is. The idea is that in the event of a bad accident, the pressure vessel would immediately snap shut. They have these isolation valves, which would snap the vessel shut so that there would be no more coolant entering or leaving the core of the reactor. And another circuit, which goes vertically upwards, would take the steam that is generated by the heat of the core, the steam, the boiling water, would go up to a pool where it would condense into normal water and fall back down into the core by gravity on a different circuit. So you have a loop that goes up from the core to the cooling pond and back down into the reactor to prevent the core from melting down. That's the isolation condenser system. It turns out that every boiling water reactor built in the past always had an isolation condenser pool similar to this. Not quite the same design, but the same idea. And in two previous occasions, it has failed. There was a precursor of the BWRX, which is called the Humboldt Bay Reactor. And back in 1970, it had a reactor accident, which resulted in fuel damage and offsite radiation releases. Why? Because the isolation condenser system failed. And that's the only system they're using now to keep these BWRXs safe. So I have recently made a presentation to the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, which is considering issuing an operating license for this reactor, pointing out that we do not know for sure what would happen if the isolation condenser system fails, as it did also in Fukushima Unit 1. In Unit 1, the isolation condenser system also failed, and that contributed to the core meltdown there. So it's a complicated technical issue, but it's easy to understand that you don't save money by eliminating safety systems. This is not a smart thing to do.
You know, Gordon, we're talking on April 1st, and I really wish... I really wish all of what you were just saying was part of an April Fool's joke, but really the April Fools are the people in Canada, the ones in power, who might, just still might, give a green light to this and allow it to move forward, as opposed to being more rational and sane and grounded.
You're absolutely right. I think that we're the April Fools here. And another thing about fools I remember is... no less a person than Edward Teller once said, there's no such thing as a foolproof system because the fool is always greater than the proof.
I'm going to keep that one. What, if any, pushback has there been against this proposal and this movement and the seeming uncritical support of Doug Ford, who is the premier of Ontario and is the one who is pushing this forward?
That's correct. We have provinces. Each province has its own prime minister, you might say, but they're called premiers because there's only one prime minister who's the prime minister of Canada. The premiers, though, rule supreme over their own provinces, except for the federal involvements, which have to do with foreign relations, has to do with the military, has to do with trade, and so on and so on. Yes, Doug Ford himself, the premier of Ontario, exports a good deal of about 13 terawatt hours of electricity to the United States, mostly New York and Michigan, and a little bit to Minnesota. And back in March 10th, he announced that he was putting a in response to the tariffs, the unjustified tariffs that Trump has levied against Canada, that he was going to put a 25% surcharge on the electricity that we're selling to the United States. And that would mean an extra $400,000 that would have to be paid by U.S. customers of Ontario electricity. When Trump heard that, he immediately dropped his own demand to increase the tariff on our aluminum and steel to 50% from 25%. He dropped that 50% tariff, dropped it back to 25%, on condition that Ford would drop this surcharge on electricity, which he did. So Ford has already shown that he's able to stand up to Trump to a limited degree. He could go further by simply saying, okay, we're canceling these orders for American reactors. These orders are going nowhere, just like the orders for our jets are perhaps going nowhere. They're under evaluation. It's not yet decided whether we're going to cancel the order for the jets. It's not yet decided whether we're going to cancel the order for the reactors, but this seems to be the way things are going.
Excuse me, I have to catch my breath. Is there any kind of public awareness and public pushback to this? Any kind of a movement that either exists or might be growing to not move forward on the nuclear reactors?
There has been, in fact, a growing public awareness, but it's still small and it has to grow rapidly if it's going to have a big impact. They haven't yet got a construction license for the Ontario version of the BWRX-300. And in fact, they haven't licensed it in the States either. In the United States, the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission has identified a number of questionable aspects of the safety case for the BWRX-300. They're not sure if it makes sense, as GE Hitachi has said, to declare that certain zones of the reactor are, quote unquote, break exclusion zones. What a break exclusion zone is, BEZ, means that it's a zone in which no pipe is allowed to break. That in these zones, there will not be any pipe breaks, period. To justify this, they're saying that we are convinced that these pipes in those particular areas of the plant will leak before they will break. And the leak before break allows them time to shut down the reactor and take precautionary action. Because if you had a sudden break of the pipe, then you would not be able to respond to it necessarily. So what the GE Hitachi team is doing is they're saying, because we declare these zones to be immune from rapid breakage, we don't have to study them. So what they're doing is they're giving themselves a free pass, saying we do not have to analyze these accidents because of the break exclusion zone, they are now beyond design basis accidents, and we don't have to study beyond design basis accidents.
Explain what beyond basis accident actually means.
Well, the thing is that nuclear reactors are inherently dangerous. They're inherently dangerous, but they're trying to pretend that they're inherently safe. And so the break exclusion zone is to say, we think it's inherently safe, provided none of these pipes have the audacity to break. Because if they break, then we can't guarantee that it's going to be safe at all. So a design basis accident is an accident that the designer is willing to analyze and take preventative measures to cope with such an accident. If it's beyond design basis, then we don't have to study it because it's too far beyond the pale and too difficult for us to cope with. I'll give you an example. We've heard about the nuclear reactors in Zaporizhia, which are being damaged by the war that's going on between Russia and Ukraine. The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is 6 nuclear reactors. It's the largest single nuclear plant in Europe. And if warfare were used, if these were attacked by warfare, by shells, that would be an accident that nobody has studied beforehand. Nobody has ever studied what the consequences of this would be, how you would cope with the results of such a so-called accident or incident. So a beyond design basis accident is an accident that, in the opinion of the industry, is so improbable that we do not have to study it. But of course, when you have a war raging, as you do in Ukraine, it's not improbable at all.
And as the saying goes, man plans, God laughs.
Exactly.
Now, Canada is currently in an election cycle, is it not?
Yes, we're having a federal election coming up in the next few weeks. In fact, in about 3 weeks, we're going to have a federal election. Prime Minister Trudeau resigned, and Mark Carney was elected head of the Liberal Party, which makes him de facto prime minister. Not because he was elected, he hasn't been elected, but simply because he's the leader of the Liberal Party. And in a parliamentary system, that's how it works. There's the party that rules, not the individual.
So how might that impact any decisions that are being made in Ontario by Doug Ford regarding the nuclear reactors?
That's very difficult to say. Both major parties in Canada at the federal level, both the Liberals and the Conservatives, are very pro-nuclear. They've always been supportive of nuclear. They regard nuclear as a hot item for selling overseas. And of course, this is also very much a concern of ours, because weaknesses in the safety case in Canada are bad enough, but if those same reactors are implanted in some third world country or some overseas country that doesn't have the experience with nuclear power, which Canada has had for many, many decades, 80 years, then the consequences can be that much worse. Also, the likelihood of major military actions in Europe are becoming increasingly worrisome. So that affects nuclear power as well. In fact, it was back in 1976 that there was a Royal Commission report issued in Britain called the Flowers Report. It was a report on nuclear energy and the environment. And the author of that report was a British nuclear scientist who worked in both the military program and the civilian program, nuclear programs. And he said that if nuclear power had been deployed in Europe before World War II, then large parts of Europe would be uninhabitable today because of World War II, because they would undoubtedly become targets in a war. By simply being targeted, if you blow one of these reactors to kingdom come, and of course the small reactors are much easier to blow up because they don't have the massive containment walls that the older reactors do. So they're much easier to explode, and yet they produce the same kind of radioactive poisons inside them that all reactors do. So you could have something far worse than a meltdown, and that is a complete evacuation of all the radioactive materials from the core of the reactor. That would cause contamination of a permanent nature over a very, very large landmass. So these are all concerns going forward, and they're generic concerns. So when we talk about design basis accidents, we're talking about situations which the industry can foresee as likely, and therefore they have to analyze, and things which they have to have devices that are intended to prevent the worst consequences from those accidents. Beyond design basis accidents are basically beyond the pale.
God, where do I take it from here? For those who are concerned about this set of issues, which you have articulated so well, what do you suggest that we do, be it Canadians only, be it the United States, other countries? How can we perhaps put up a firewall between these really bad decisions of nukes and it going forward?
It's difficult because people are mystified by nuclear technology. They always have been, and they're less mystified than they used to be. They now realize that the old reactors, the ones that we built back in the 60s and 50s and 70s even, they really stopped building these reactors around 1976, even before the Three Mile Island accident. They had stopped building new reactors in North America. As a matter of fact, you know, you've heard perhaps about four reactors that were built down in Georgia and South Carolina, the AP1000 reactors. These were large reactors. In fact, Westinghouse went bankrupt over the $9 billion loss it made on two of those reactors in South Carolina, which were in fact canceled, even though they were almost all built. They just canceled them. They felt that they couldn't complete building them because they already were bankrupt. They did, however, finish the ones in Georgia, and those ones are now operating. Well, they were the first reactors ordered and given a construction license by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in over 30 years. So there's been a long hiatus. Many people are perhaps unaware of the fact that for the last 25 years, the nuclear industry worldwide has been in a steep decline. Their market share of global electricity has declined in those 25 years from 17% of the total electricity globally to only 9% today, and it's still going down. So the nuclear option is very much on the decline. And the ones that are running are generally very old, and they're going to be shut down fairly soon. They're trying to keep them alive by giving them heart transplants and resuscitating them, and maybe putting in a new set of lungs, I don't know. But at any rate, it's not possible to restore these things to their original condition. And even their original condition was unable to cope with all the consequences of all the accidents. Look at Three Mile Island as an example of that. So what we're facing here is when the climate crisis really took hold and people realized that trillions of dollars were going to be put aside to deal with the climate crisis, the nuclear industry saw this as an opportunity to grab as much of that money as they possibly could. And so what they did is they were well positioned by having people in government on their side, people who actually represented the industry at one point in their careers. And they figured that they could get public money to build a host of new speculative nuclear reactors. The Natrium reactor, that's one that uses liquid sodium coolant instead of water. The BWRX, the boiling water reactors, which use water. The molten salt reactors, which use melted salt as a coolant. All these reactors are achieving a lot of public funding, and they're not going to make much difference in the global scheme of things because they're too slow and too expensive to fight climate change. And they represent too small a portion of the energy budget. As I said, it has been declining sharply. And when I say, for example, that the market share of electricity in nuclear has gone down from 17% to 9%, that's electricity, but electricity is only one slice of the energy pie. If you look at overall energy globally, then nuclear never supplied more than about 3.3% of the total energy. And now it's down to under 2% of the total energy. So with the idea that nuclear can solve the climate crisis, this is a complete fallacy. It can't possibly solve the climate crisis. It's much too slow, much too expensive. And in the case of these reactors, none of them have been tried and tested. Whereas renewable energy is galloping along at a very rapid pace. In fact, the International Energy Authority has forecast that in the next 10 years, 90% of all new electricity establishments and new electricity generating facilities worldwide are going to be renewable. So renewables are really, they're fast to deploy. They pay themselves back in a few seasons, much faster payback time than nuclear. And you can really make rapid headway on climate change. And that's what most of the countries in the world are doing. They're investing in these renewables and they're making rapid reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. With nuclear, you don't make any reduction. You actually add to the greenhouse emissions as long as you're just constructing them and mining the uranium and enriching the uranium. All this just adds to the greenhouse gases. It's only when the reactors start up, which often takes 10 years or more, that they begin to pay back the carbon dioxide debt that they've already built up. And it takes about an equal length of time, 10 more years, before they begin to pay themselves back economically. With wind and solar, you get payback in a couple of seasons and you can reinvest that money in more wind and more solar. And so it multiplies very rapidly and overtakes the climate crisis much more quickly. And in fact, there's no speculation for these facilities. We know they work. They've all been tested and tried. We know they work. And they don't require the specialized workforces to build them either. The nuclear industry is complaining they do not have enough trained people to actually build thousands of new reactors. Where are they going to come from, these people? Well, you don't face that same difficulty when you're building solar installations and wind installations. Those people can come from almost anywhere as long as they have a good technical background.
What do we do? What would be your suggestion for those of us who are appalled by this situation?
People have got to figure out how to make their voices heard in an effective way. Unfortunately, this is something that no single person can do, but collectively we have the power to do it. It's a question of really having the tenacity and the courage and the conviction. Unfortunately, people who don't have anything to gain financially from this, but they have a lot to gain in terms of doing the right thing, in terms of feeling that they're accomplishing something for the world and for the benefit of their children and grandchildren. It's not filling their own pockets. It's doing what's best for the planet as a whole. Do you remember, for example, the millions of people who marched in New York City against nuclear weapons. At that time, that did have an impact. You know, Reagan, for example, came very close to agreeing with Gorbachev to actually end all nuclear weapons production in both countries. They didn't do it, but they came very close to it. A lot of that has to be attributed to the fact that people found the courage to manifest their determination in large numbers. That's what we need. And I don't know how to bring it about. I don't have a magic wand, but I think that people have got to realize that this is really a fight not only for America or Canada or whatever country you want to mention it, but it's for the planet as a whole. And, you know, none of the people who are elected to office are really in charge of the planet as a whole. They're only in charge of their little piece of territory. As a result, they think the Earth is almost a flat Earth because the borders of their particular domain are determined, and they think that they can just shove the nuclear waste off the edge of the Earth and then it'll never come back and bite them. That means oftentimes putting it up near the borders, down near Mexico, up near Canada, over near California, wherever they want to put it, and therefore getting rid of these wastes. The Earth is round. You can't get rid of these things, and therefore we should stop multiplying them. I think that people have got to see the simple logic of learning how to live off our energy income, which nature gives us every single year, inexhaustibly, in terms of solar energy, in terms of wind, in terms of geothermal energy. That's the way we should be going, instead of relying on non-renewable resources, which are highly polluting, such as fossil fuels and nuclear.
Gordon, it's always, I want to use the old hippie term, a trip. It's always amazingly enlightening to speak with you, to hear your clarity on all of this. And as bad as the news is, know that with understanding, we have the option of taking action.
We know what to do. We just don't know how to do it in terms of the levers of power. We have unfortunately surrendered the levers of power to people who are dominated by baser motives, motives of greed, motives of power, motives of domination, motives of revenge in some cases. So I think that these are not the kind of motivations we need to make a planet that is more livable for all of us.
As always, I am in awe of the width and breadth and depth and height, 21 stories or more, of your understanding of these issues. And I want to thank you for once again sharing them with the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be on this program, and I'm glad that you are doing what you're doing. I think you are putting the news out there for a lot of people. Everybody has to feel that they're empowered to motivate the people around them. We tend to underestimate the power of a chain reaction. You know, splitting one atom releases very little energy. It's only by splitting trillions of atoms that you get a lot of energy. But the way it works is the splitting of one atom causes the splitting of two more, and that causes the splitting of four more, and that causes the splitting of eight more. If every individual listening to this show could influence just two people in their immediate vicinity in such a way that those two people are motivated to influence two other people, you have started a chain reaction of awareness and conviction, which is amazing in its power. We sometimes think that because the mass media is not on our side, we can't really have much effect. But you know, the ex-Soviet Union did not have a friendly mass media, and yet people managed to make their voices heard just by word of mouth. South Africa, the apartheid regime, had no free press, and yet they, by using their individual voices and their individual convictions, were able to make a powerful movement. And we can do the same. Just because we're living in a relatively luxurious state, many of us, doesn't mean we have to be inactive.
From your mouth to every ear that is hearing this program. Dr. Gordon Edwards, thank you so much for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Very welcome.
Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. You can find the group's website at ccnr.org. A few additional points. To clarify the cost to U.S. ratepayers in Michigan, Minnesota, and New York for importing electricity from Canada, should Trump's tariffs and Canada's proposed retaliatory surcharge on exported energy be instituted, The surcharge will affect 1.5 million homes and businesses, costing up to $400,000 every day the surcharge remains in place. Dr. Edwards mentioned four reactors at two sites in the U.S. as examples of what can go wrong with planned nuclear construction. Two of the reactors are at Vogtle in Georgia, which, after 11 years of construction, were originally expected to cost $14 billion with a B U.S. dollars. But as regularly happens with all things nuclear, the project suffered construction delays and cost overruns that more than doubled the price tag to where it exceeded $30 billion with a B U.S. dollars. The other nuclear build he mentioned is the late, unlamented V.C. Summer in South Carolina. The two reactors there were abandoned without generating a single watt of electricity after 9 years and $9 billion. Every ratepayer in the state will be paying this $9 billion off on their monthly energy bills for the next 15 years. The U.S. primarily imports its uranium fuel from Russia, and despite that country's ongoing war with Ukraine, there is not and never has been an embargo against importing nuclear fuel from that country. And the use of the term small, as in small modular nuclear reactors, is a reference to the power output, not the size of the unit. Finally, there are two links for more information on this episode. The first is a YouTube video of Dr. Edwards' oral testimony on the BWRX-300 license application. That's a YouTube video. And there's a news story on the surcharge on electricity exports to the U.S. Both are linked on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 719.
Activists, shout out.
As listeners to this show are well aware, this year, 2025, marks the 80th anniversary of the first nuclear explosion in New Mexico, followed within a month by the nuclear annihilation of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki by two U.S. atom bombs. Today, the nuclear threat continues, with more than 12,000 nuclear weapons held by nine countries, which is what makes the 14th Rio de Janeiro Uranium Film Festival more important than ever. It remembers this threat with exceptional films on atomic weapons and nuclear risks. In addition, there's something to commemorate and celebrate this year. Last October, the IUFF was honored as one of the 25 coolest film festivals in the world 2024 by the prestigious Movie Maker magazine in Hollywood. This year, in March of 2025, the festival founders, Marcio Gomez de Oliveira and Norbert Sucheneck, received the Nuclear Free Future Award for Education in New York. This award honors the largely unsung heroes of the nuclear age who work to rid the world of nuclear weapons and for a world without nuclear risks. This year's 14th Uranium Film Festival will take place at the Cinemateca do MAM in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, May 17 to 31st. It's free admission and is open to anyone over the age of 14. We will have a link up to the IUFF site so that you can see some of the films that are being presented, and it's a really incredible lineup. The festival is also making plans to travel around the United States and go to several additional countries. Meanwhile, we'll have a link up to their website on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 718. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 1st, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email each week, it is the easiest way to make certain you never miss out on a single episode. Sign up for it by going to nuclearhotseat.com. You will see a yellow opt-in box. You really can't miss it. So put in your first name and an email address, and every week you will get one, just count it, one email with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. We do not sell or share our list, and unless something extraordinary comes up, you only get the one. Now, if you like the show and you would like to help us out, you're on the ground in your part of the world, So you see what's going on nuclear there that maybe we don't know about. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that information in an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. And as always, we appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as physicist Edward Teller, known as the father of the hydrogen bomb, said, there's no such thing as a foolproof system, because the fool is always greater than the proof. He was talking about nuclear. And there you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So wake up, and whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.